Good. Okay. All right. Good evening, everybody. Let's get started. Our topic for tonight is the fifth Aliyah, and we're going to discuss basically the years 1931 to 1936. The fifth Aliyah was the largest of all the pre-war Aliyot. In fact, it was the size of all the other ones combined. And it was a time when the Yishuv was built up to substantial numbers. But the most controversial aspect of the fifth Aliyah, and maybe the most controversial decision in all of the pre-war Zionism, is the Hiskem HaHavara, the transfer agreement, which I've mentioned in the past briefly. I want to discuss it at some length now, and to explain how in its time it was a controversial matter, and even years and years later in the historiography, the writing of the story, it remained a controversial matter. Did the Zionists collaborate with the Nazis? It sounds damning. It sounds not kosher. But what really happened? So, in 1984, Edwin Black wrote a book. The title of the book was The Transfer Agreement, The Untold Story of the Secret Pact Between the Third Reich and Jewish Palestine. And this book exposed to a wider audience the story of the Havara. It had not been a secret. The title was silly. I mean, the matter was known to the general public from the day it started in 1933, in June of 1933. But because it's not a widely known topic in the history of our people or in history generally, you could have a sensationalist title that says The Secret Pact Between the Nazis and the Jews. Well, this book was cited by Louis Farrakhan and Lyndon LaRouche, two of the Gedolim of anti-Semitism, all right, to prove that Zionism is racism and the Jews are evil and were complicit with the Nazis. So it became necessary for the good American Jewish historians, the likes of Ben Halpern and Henry Feingold, to criticize Black's book and to say that he's off base on most of his historical assertions. Black responded by saying he wasn't trying to defame the Zionist movement, but rather just to show that they were forced by circumstances into an agonizing choice. And they made a choice to deal with the devil rather than to boycott the devil. Who is Edwin Black? He's an American Jew, son of Polish Holocaust survivors. Why does that matter? Well, maybe it doesn't matter. However, I would say it does. Polish Holocaust survivors, not German Holocaust survivors. There's a difference in attitude between the Jews of Poland and the Jews of Germany. And I'll explain why that is the case. So, after the Nazi rise to power, with Hitler's ascension to the chancellorship on June 30th, 1933, the question was, what will American Jews do about it? What will Western Jewry more generally do about the fate of Germany being in the hands of vicious anti-Semites? So the American Jewish war veterans, and there were thousands of them who had fought in World War I, called for an anti-German boycott. Total boycott of all German products. The American Jewish Congress, under Stephen Wise, called for a rally to be held at Madison Square Garden on March 27th, 1933. My great-grandfather, Grandpa Izzy, was at that rally. Wow. All right? And this was a big deal. You could get 25,000 people in the arena decrying the situation of Nazi persecution of the Jews. The Nazis, Hitler himself actually, became aware of this rally that was scheduled for a few days hence and warned Stephen Wise through intermediaries that if the rally happens, there'll be serious repercussions for German Jewry. This is a threat. That you don't say boo, because if you do anything, I'm going to make it worse. Correct.
This was before or after their big rally in
Madison Square Garden? Huh? The Bund had a rally later. This was a few years later, yeah. Before, correct. So, despite the threat that there would be repercussions for German Jews if American Jewry is galvanized in sort of an anti-Nazi fervor, this rally went ahead anyway. And on April 1st, there was a one-day boycott by the entire German public of German Jewish businesses. Well, the Nazis did not have full control of the government at the time. They would not have full control until the Night of the Long Knives, when all the other contenders to power would be eliminated by Hitler, where the SS would wipe out the SA. But before that, Hindenburg is still nominally in charge, and Hitler is only the chancellor, not the Führer yet, and so he has to take into consideration the political sensitivities of the old line conservatives, who might not have liked Jews especially, but were not vicious, vicious, murderous anti-Semites. And so therefore, anti-Jewish measures had to be of a more restrained nature, and not the likes of which we would see with the Nuremberg Laws in 35, and then Kristallnacht in 38, and then in the final solution, 41 and onward. It had to be little by little, because he doesn't have full control yet. So, boycotts, and eliminating Jews from the civil service, which was the first significant law passed by the Nazi regime, was all they could do in 1933 to oust Jews, to muscle Jews out of the economy. Well, not entirely. The Nuremberg Laws in 35 are really what stripped them of their citizenship. But as early as April of 33, it was looking very bad. And
the deal they made with the Nazis.
Yeah.
They paid money, I assume. That's what I mean.
Yes, I'm going to explain exactly where the money went. Okay. So why does the Hesquem Ha'avara come to exist, this transfer agreement? Well, it's a combination of two laws that were on the books that have really nothing to do with the extermination of the Jews and the Holocaust. They're laws that were not passed by the Nazis. One law was passed by the pre-Nazi German government in 1931, and another law was passed by the British administration in Palestine. What are these two laws that I'm referring to? The first one is, 1931, the German government and the Weimar regime passes a law that says if you leave the country, you can only take with you 200 Reichsmarks, which is the equivalent of about 13 American dollars at the time. In other words, you can't take your money out of the country. Now, why was this law passed? Because Germany was in economic depression, and they don't want to have their moneyed elite taking all the capital, the financial capital, out of the country and depositing it elsewhere and then leaving themselves, because you would bankrupt the country even further. So if you want to leave, that's fine, but your money stays here. So that's one law, having nothing to do with the Jews. It's just a pure economic situation in Germany. It wasn't so simple to have foreign bank accounts in those years and to wire the money from one branch to another. So,
but didn't they have rampant inflation at that time? So
yes,
it wasn't really worth that much.
That's true. But let's say you had gold or silver, you had precious metals. All value, it wasn't just a fiat currency that was restricted. Anything that was an asset could not leave the country. Okay. It was very difficult, very difficult. So that's one law. The second law was passed by the British administration in Eretz Yisrael sometime in the 1920s, although it was revised in the early 30s, was that capitalists are not included in the immigration quota into the country for Jews. Every 6 months, there was a new schedule issued for the immigration of various categories of Jews. Workers, laborers, agricultural laborers, industrial laborers, rabbis, Luftmenschen, whatever it is, you name it, there are categories of people who are entitled to certificates to enter into the country. However, if you're a capitalist, you don't have to have a certificate under the quota. You can go beyond the quota, which is very good. Okay, what's a capitalist? Anyone with capital. All right. So how much capital? So you needed 500 pounds sterling. They'd revised it to 1,000 pounds sterling, which in American dollars at that time was about $5,000. Okay. So for Eastern European Jews, that would be a lot of money, and likely such Jews would not be able to enter as capitalists. They'd have to enter under the quota. But for middle class, especially upper middle class German Jews or Austrian Jews or other Western European Jews, if you sold your business, you sold your house, and you could have that much money. It was such a big deal to have that much in total assets if you wanted to move. So you need to have money to get into Palestine, but you can't take your money out of Germany. The money's there. It just can't go from point A to point B. So, yeah.
Was it per person or per family?
It was per person.
That's already a lot of money.
Yeah, it could be. But some people had that much money. So what can be done? In June of 1933, and by the way, the reason why the capitalists were allowed beyond the quota was because the quota was designed not to overburden the economy, that the absorptive capacity of the Jewish side of the economy was supposed to be able to take these people in and provide them with employment, reasonable employment, that they shouldn't be a public charge and be on welfare, but rather be able to survive on their own. If you flood the country with too many people at one time, it's a disaster, economic disaster, as opposed to if you have a significant amount of financial capital, then you can create your own space in the economy, and not only that, you have your own housing, whatever it is, but that the infusion of cash into the economy will facilitate the absorption of other people who don't have money, meaning the chalutzim who come from Poland, from Galicia, wherever, they come with bupkis. But because there's more money here, because some rich German Jews came, now we can afford to absorb everyone. That's the idea. It will help increase the capacity. So, in June of 33, negotiations are happening with the Jewish agency. Chaim Orlosserov is involved in these negotiations, and he's killed 2 days after the deal is signed, on June 16th, 1933. Why is it that a deal to arrange for the departure of Jews and their assets to Palestine, why is it that that was in the interests of the German government? Why do they want this? They only sign a deal if they think it's a good deal for them. Why are they signing off on this? Okay, good. So the Nazi regime wants to be rid of its Jews, and they also want to do things that are financially beneficial to the country. Those elements within the government that were not hardline genocidal Nazi types, that were more of a moderate nature, they had three reasons why they might favor this deal. One, it's a humane alternative to the more barbaric ways of getting rid of Jews. So if you know that your fellow members of the cabinet would commit atrocities to make the country Judenrein, but that bothers you, but you still don't like Jews and you want them gone, this is a great way to have them gone without having to kill them. Number two, trading concessions for German industrial companies. What's going to happen, I'll explain what the deal actually is, it will help German businesses sell their goods. In particular, items that they had trouble selling on the open market. So this will help the business interests of Germany.
They're
going to sell it to Palestine. Then three, it breaks the Jewish boycott. Because if the World Zionist Organization and the Jewish Agency for Palestine, which are the most influential international Jewish organizations in the world at that time, are not participating in the boycott of Nazi Germany, and in fact they're doing the opposite of boycotting, they're actively engaged in commercial transactions, then it breaks the Jewish consensus. And there's nothing the Nazis like better, or the German government likes better, than breaking the Jewish consensus. That there's no unity in Klal Yisrael, that they're factionalized, and we're the reason why they're factionalized. Okay. So, how did the deal actually work? Let me explain. The German Jew who wanted to move was able to keep the 500 or later 1,000 pounds sterling in his possession and go to Eretz Yisrael. So he had sufficient resources to be entered into the country as a capitalist. The British wouldn't include him in the quota. The rest of his stuff, his assets, which were sold off and converted into to money, would be held by the Paltrow Trust. The Palestine Troy is something or other trust, some German name. And who operated this trust? Representatives of the Jewish Agency, operating in Germany. And the money never left Germany. Then what happens? The Paltrow Trust provides a loan or forwards money on behalf of industrial businesses in Palestine, Jewish businesses, whether Hanotea or the Dead Sea Works or the electrification company or the cement company, various major industries that are run by Jews in Eretz Yisrael, are fronted money to buy German industrial equipment. The equipment is shipped to Eretz Yisrael. Now these companies have the money, but they didn't really pay for it. So what do? They reimburse the Jew who comes from Germany and arrives on the scene in the Yishuv and give them cash in Eretz Yisrael. So in fact, money never left Germany. The money stayed in Germany, but the products came to Israel, the people came to Israel, and the people were reimbursed when they got to Israel. Okay, so this is, everyone is a winner. Okay, so... Okay, so how much less did they get? That's the real question. No, nobody's getting 100% of their money back. Good. So the Nazis took 25% off the top as an exit penalty. And the Jews took another 25% off the top to cover national projects. What are national projects? The absorption of those immigrants who can't afford to come on their own and whose passage is being paid for by the Jewish Agency, the World Zionist Organization, etc. So the individual Jew gets to have his life and half his money and live in Israel.
Could you please read that again?
Yeah.
Let's say a person had a lot of furniture.
Yeah.
Part of this deal.
So everything was sold off in Germany. Nothing left Germany. No money left Germany. The only thing that leaves Germany are the people, the Jews themselves, and industrial equipment purchased by Palestinian Jewish firms that need these items. Now, the reason why it was very beneficial to Germany is, aside from the fact that they get to confiscate 25% of the assets, also the businesses were able to sell their products that were... maybe not selling on the open market, but the Palestinian Jewish customer is desperate for these items that they can't get otherwise, and they'll pay more than the retail value. So everybody's benefiting, they're taking a cut along the way, but at least the Jew gets most of his money back or half his money back and gets to live. Okay, yeah.
So for these somewhat absolute Jews,
yeah.
Is their only option? They could not go to any other country?
So the answer to that is... German Jews could go to a variety of places if they could get in, if they were lucky enough to get a visa. The United States, some went to the United States between 33 and 39 of those who could get in. There was a quota for Germany, and it wasn't a very large one, but they could get in if they were lucky. Or they could go to Western Europe. The problem with going to Western Europe is, in the long run, doesn't save you if you go to France or you go to Belgium. But they didn't know that at the time. Okay, if you go to England, you get to, your life is spared. But no. So people who went to other countries, for the most part, had to give up their possessions. They went largely impoverished. Not entirely. Sometimes people were able to get something out, but for the most part, they didn't have their possessions. Now, if you were an educated person and your capital was intellectual capital, you could restart your career wherever you found yourself. But if you were a business person without much education, so maybe you'd restart a business if you could, but all you had built up was confiscated from you. All right. Yes,
anyway.
Yes. And the Jews became employees in their own businesses, not owners. Okay, so another part of the deal was that Germany agreed to buy surplus Jaffa oranges. This might sound like a throwaway line, but it's actually very important. The orange crop, the citrus crop, became the major export of Jewish Palestine in the 1920s. But by the 1930s, especially during the Depression, there was a shrinking of the international market for these oranges. And there were too many producers of the oranges. So a significant percentage of the yield was going to waste every year. For Germany to buy the surplus was very helpful to the Jaffa orange growers. Okay, now. No, it lasted 5 years. We'll see how much money and how many people were involved in all this. So the American Jewish boycott of Germany continued despite the Havara Agreement. If the Palestinian Jews are dealing with the devil, but the American Jews shouldn't. And it was run by Samuel Untermeyer, a leading American figure. Stephen Wise was still hedging his bets. He didn't know whether to lead his American Jewish Congress and the World Jewish Conference into the boycott or against the boycott.
The issue of
Pidyon Shvuyim, yeah. So, yes, but Pidyon Shvuyim was not something that was really an option, because the Germans were not looking to take money from the outside in exchange for the release of Jews. During the war, the War Refugee Board in 1944 would be involved in that sort of things, the Trucks for Blood scenario, and the Bergson Group during the war was plastering the New York newspapers with all sorts of, you know, Jew for sale, Jew for sale. But in the 1930s, that was not on the agenda. So it's Hatzalat Nefashot, but not Pidyon Shvuyim in the conventional sense of paying money to get specific people out. Okay, so Untermeyer is running the boycott. Wise is hedging his bets. Now, why is that the case? Because Stephen Wise is the leader of American Zionism. And if the WZO is in favor of the Havara and not in favor of the boycott, as a good Zionist, as a team player, he's not going to want to go against the World Zionist Organization. So while he supported the boycott in principle, he didn't do anything among his organizational crowd to actually put it into effect. Okay, so getting back to Edwin Black and the book that people use to besmirch the Jews and Israel. Black criticized the American Jewish Committee, B'nai B'rith, and the Central Verein für Deutschen Juden, the central organization for German Jews in Germany, for not supporting the boycott, on the premise that, in Black's view, the only honorable position that one could have taken was to support the boycott, that any deal with the devil is a deal with the devil and it is inappropriate. He accused them of wanting to protect their middle-class lifestyle more than their political rights. What is that? It's a very serious accusation. What he's saying here is that if the Jews believed that Nazism was a passing cloud and that the emancipation of German Jews in the 19th century was in the long run going to be sustained, and that the Nazis are only going to be in charge for a year, two, three, ten, whatever it is, but that there's a future for German Jewry, there's a future for European Jewry, then maybe you're more interested in protecting your economic position than in fighting for political rights that have been temporarily compromised. You can understand why someone might accuse those who are dealing with the devil of focusing on the money aspect and not on the abstract political rights aspect.
But there were people who felt it would pass.
That's true, correct. There are plenty of people who did think that, especially between 33 and 36, or even to 38. Okay. Well, in fact, these organizations, including the Central Verein, engaged in private shtadlanut, old line private diplomacy, of the wealthy macher talking to the person in a political position, and that the rally, the boycott, the big show might not be the most efficacious way of getting the favorable outcome. As sometimes the private diplomacy, the shtadlanut, works better. Moreover, there were those in the United States who believed that an American Jewish boycott and an American Jewish call for a broader American Gentile boycott of Germany would foment anti-Semitism in America, because the American economy was in depression and could ill afford further restraints on free trade. And if you're going to impose a restraint on free trade just because the Germans are being bad to the Jews, well, then domestically here, anti-Semitism could get worse. No, no.
It was free trade.
Yeah, yeah. Basically, until the war. I mean, I there's a caveat to that. You have Lend-Lease, which is favoring the British,
yeah.
But in terms of commercial enterprises, they're not government enterprises here up until the day the war started. Okay. So, the Central Verein in Germany, they had statistical data that said over a 40-year span between 1893, with the Depression of 1893, and 1933, the trend was that when unemployment went up, anti-Semitism went up. And when unemployment went down, anti-Semitism went down. So their theory was, don't boycott the German economy, don't weaken the economy, because if the economy gets worse, we'll be further doomed. Better the economy should be good, and maybe the Germans will come to their senses and oust the Nazis from power. That's the thinking. Of course, in hindsight, we know over the Holocaust, it may sound a little foolish. Okay. So, Another criticism that, Edwin Black raises is of Wise for acting out of personal aggrandizement and out of jealousy to other American Jewish leaders, that his approach to public diplomacy was not so much to secure the favorable outcome, so much as it was to sustain his own access to the people in power. There are Yes, by Rafi Medoff. Okay, so there's a lot of truth to this. There are people in the Jewish community who are very prominent, whose way of operating is, I need to have access to the president, to the secretary of state, blah, 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 fill in the blank, and as long as I get to shake their hand periodically, all's well in the world. Even though all's not well in the world, I got to shake their hand, which means all's well in the world. All right? Well, he criticized the Zionists for the following, and this I will agree with him to an extent, that because the Zionists regarded anti-Semitism as a permanent feature of the diaspora, and that the diaspora has no future, shtilat hagalut, so they viewed fighting for Jewish rights as being a lost cause, and focused instead on German Jewish lives and money, not so much as hatzalat nefashot, in the traditional sense of I want to save a human life, but rather that the people are chomer enoshi. What is chomer enoshi? Human material. Human material resources to build up the yeshuv. That I don't care about Goldberg in Germany because Goldberg is a human being with innate value. I care about Goldberg because as a Jew in Palestine, he's another person on the roster, on the demographic list to beat out the Arabs for control of the country. And his money, I don't care about his money, that he should have his money, I care that we should have his money. Okay? So Chomer Enoshi is a very unpleasant, it's an ugly expression, but there's an element of truth to it. Okay, granted, yes. Okay. So, Black believed that had the boycott been universally applied by all Jews, including the Zionist movement, that the Nazis could have been toppled in 1933. That is historical fantasy. That could never have been. All the other historians criticized his book for making all sorts of leaps of faith about what might have been had the boycott been stronger and without any holes in the ranks. Okay, so what was the end result of Havara? How many people, how much money came to Eretz Yisrael? The high-end estimates are that 60,000 people came and $100 million, roughly equivalent to American dollars, showed up in Eretz Yisrael. The more restrained numbers, the low-end number, is about 20,000 people and $40 million. Well, either way you slice it, it's a significant number of people. Considering the overall size of the yeshuv, which in the 1930s is growing from 175,000 to 450,000, and it's a lot of money because the yeshuv was poor, didn't have a lot of money, okay? and it did make a significant difference in building up the yeshuv to a level of sustainability that it could withstand the Arab riots of the late 30s. Okay. Havara was declining after 1937. And the Nazis restricted the kinds of goods that were available for export. And in 1938, the British eliminated the capitalist exemption from the quota. So the whole point of Havara kind of was moot by that time. However, it had been so successful in the years that it was implemented that Werner Feichenfeld, who was the leader of the appointment for Havara on the ground, he wanted to extend that deal to Poland, Romania, Hungary, and Czechoslovakia. Let's make a deal with those countries too. You know, they don't like their Jews. They'd like them to leave. They're probably they have laws in the books that don't facilitate the free flow of goods. Let's make a deal with them. The outbreak of war on September 1st, 1939 made this an impossibility. But it was such a success for a while that it was thought of extending it to other countries.
Did people know that they were part of this program?
Oh, sure, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, it was the only voluntary thing. Nobody could force you to deposit your assets in some trust in a German branch of the Anglo-Palestine Bank. It was, you chose to do this in conjunction with Jewish agency handlers.
So there was enough German Jews who either knew what was going to happen or were very Zionist to go along with it.
Okay, so I'm glad you mentioned that because that leads us to the next half of tonight's talk, which is the cultural angle. Who are these people? how Jewish are they? So, in 1935, and by the way, 1935 was the high point for Aliyah. 62,000 people came to Eretz Yisrael. Jews came to Eretz Yisrael in 1935, the largest number of any year prior to the creation of the state. About half. So, the others came from Poland and from Czechoslovakia and some from Hungary.
Russia was not,
Russia was not a source of immigration because Russia was closed off. Very, Hungary, not too many. Only Fabrenta Zionists, which there were some. But
Romania.
Huh? No, no. There was no basket of goodies you get at the door when you come in. All right. So, in 1935, Beryl Katznelson, who was the editor of Davar, the head of the Mapai newspaper, and one of the leading ideologues of the labor Zionism, and Ben-Gurion's right-hand man, so he wrote an article titled "Turning Goyim into Jews." Now, this was not about the Beit Din for conversion with the mikveh. This is not that kind of turning Goyim into Jews. No. This is taking people who are by ethnic background Jews, but who by their cultural affinities totally devoid of Judaic content, and yet who now are coming to Eretz Yisrael, the Jewish homeland, and you need to turn them into a fully functioning Jew, that they should want to participate in the national venture that is the Yishuv, that is Tzionut, Zionism. And these are people who, up until the moment they got off the boat at Jaffa or at Haifa, had nothing to do with Tzionut and hardly anything to do with Judaism. Veine Giddishkeit. So, in the second half of the 1930s, Zionist leaders shifted their focus a little bit to cultural matters because of the arrival of non-ideological Olim who didn't know Hebrew or Judaism. There are certain Zionist slogans that these people had no part of. Hag Shama. What is Hag Shama?
Fulfillment,
self-actualization, realization, whatever it is. This was a big deal in Tzionut, Hag Shama, that you have an idea and you want to fulfill this idea through your own very person. Livnot ulibanot, to build the land and to be built yourself. You change your character by participating in this grand project of the Jewish national home. Right, okay, this was very foreign to them. Ivrit, the Hebrew language. Okay, you speak the Hebrew language. All this is very foreign to the non-ideological Olim from Central Europe. So, what do you do about it? Well, Zionism had, for a bunch of decades up to, at that point, engaged in Shlilat HaGalut, negating the diaspora. Now, negating the diaspora didn't just mean that you say there's no future for you in the diaspora, you have to move to Israel. Negating the diaspora meant that you were belittling the Jewish ways of life in the diaspora, which may include the Jewish religion, by the way, especially if you're an avowed secularist or an agnostic or an atheist, and many of the labor Zionists were, okay, or belittling Yiddish in favor of Hebrew, or belittling just the minhagim, the mores, the ways of life, the style of life of the Jew from Warsaw, Vilna, Lodz, or for that matter, even Berlin, okay, in favor of the way we live in Eretz Yisrael. But some, but most not. Most ended up staying. Right, there wasn't. After the war, some people left. In the late 40s, plenty of the German Jews who spent some time in Israel did come to America, but not the bulk of them. Bulk of them stayed. Okay, so the Shtilat HaGalut is a problem now. Because if you negate the diaspora completely, and these people didn't have much Jewish content in their lives when they were in the diaspora, then they're hardly Jewish at all. They're basically a Jewish goy living in Tel Aviv, riding out a decade of persecution, not blending into the national home, and when the decade of persecution is over, what might they then do? get out and go back to Europe or go to America or go to Australia, who knows what. But so the point is, in the 1930s, what do the Zionist leaders care about? The coalescing of the Jews of Eretz Yisrael and having as many Jews as possible in Eretz Yisrael to build up this national home. And they're grateful for the arrival of these German Jews, but if and only if they're really going to participate in this national project. If they're on the margins and never going to integrate, well, it's not good.
Embrace them.
Okay.
Yes,
but what does it mean? I have no choice. I have no choice but to live in the Middle East temporarily. I don't have to behave like the orange growers or the factory workers. I can still. So, that's a good question. It's a good question, but the economy isn't everything. The culture also is something. If they remain aloof and don't speak Hebrew and only speak German and don't interact with the rest of the yeshuv, there's something problematic here.
And no nationalism.
If they're making
right.
money, if they're making money, they're hiring the guy who can't speak Hebrew.
All right, so in the long run, that's how it's in the long run, that's how it's going to work itself out. You're right. So
yeah, but the Zionists were all that embracing, you know.
No, they could be very nasty at times. So the only 21% of the Fifth Aliyah was actually from Germany. 21%. There's this false notion that they were the bulk of the Fifth Aliyah. They were not. The bulk of the Fifth Aliyah was from Eastern Europe. However, this element, even from Eastern Europe, wasn't the most Jewish in character. Judaism and Hebrew had suffered a decline pretty much everywhere. The countries that the successor states in Eastern Europe that were established after World War I all had minorities clauses in their constitution, but were all violated at one point or another. Poland wasn't always good. Poland was briefly good, you know, from 26 to 36 when Pilsudski died. It was downhill after that. Romania was never good. Hungary was okay until 1940. Czechoslovakia was usually pretty good until Czechoslovakia didn't exist anymore. But there were reasons to try to escape Eastern Europe. So Austria was not the best place, especially after the fascists won elections in 1934. So people wanted to get out. Now, the focus of the Zionist leadership was now on Tarbut Ivrit, Hebrew culture, that not enough attention had been paid to Tarbut Ivrit, and something needs to be done. Especially for those new arrivals who were not Zionist or not born-again Zionist. Because some people were not really Zionist, but when they got to Israel, they're like a born-again Christian, a born-again Zionist. Oh, it's wonderful here. So the lack of Hebrew and Judaism threatened the viability of the national revival, and cultural programs were only touching a limited clientele. Who was reading a Hebrew newspaper? Not too many. Who was hearing Hebrew in the cafes? Not too many. In the synagogue, it was estimated that one-third of the yeshuv in the 1930s was a synagogue-going Jews. One-third. It's not a lot, but all right, something. And the drashot that they were hearing in the synagogue, in what language were they given?
Yiddish.
So you're not hearing culture in Hebrew. You're hearing it either in German, in Yiddish, or Polish even, or Russian. So it was necessary to invent a new culture. The Vad Le'umi and the Jewish Agency in the mid-30s established culture departments, which they didn't have before. They had political departments, economic departments. Now they have cultural departments. And the goal is to make Hebrew the vernacular. So what can you do? Teach Bible. Bring back the Bible. The Tanakh. Make the Tanakh important again. Also, support Hebrew writers. That there should be the belles lettres, that people should be reading literature and not Shakespeare in Hebrew translation that serves no purpose, but rather Jewish writings, original writings in the Hebrew. Yeah.
This, like certainly the Germans and the Austrians, for that time of many years ago, they were very elitist. Yeah.
Yes.
They still never got their European high culture out of
the No, system. They didn't. That's true. They were. Listen, there was a German newspaper being published in Israel until the 1980s from these people who came in the 30s. It fizzled out eventually when they all died. That's right. They'd be rolling over in their grave. Okay. So there had been too much emphasis on the Binyan Chomri, the material concerns, and not enough on spiritual concerns. Even in the diaspora, there was a problem. There was a decline in Hebrew in the interwar period. Why was there a decline in Hebrew, even in Chutz La'aretz, in the interwar period? So think about what happened. Number one, the best Hebraists moved to Israel. So you lose your best because they make Aliyah. Secondly, Russia was cut off. Many of the great Hebraists were in Russia. And the 3 million Jews are now out of the picture completely. They're behind the Iron Curtain, where Hebrew is being persecuted. And even the handful that can sneak out of Russia, we're finding that what? The Hebrew is being suppressed. Even Yiddish is eventually suppressed. But Yiddish was used as a mechanism to suppress Hebrew. How so? How does Yiddish suppress Hebrew? How do you spell Shabbos? Good. So instead of Shin Beis Tuf, it's Shin Aleph Beis Ayin Samech. Shabbos. That Soviet Yiddish was designed to destroy Lashon Kodesh, destroy the Hebrew component of Yiddish. Okay, what else happened? There was a lot of destruction, devastation in World War I, and in the period between 1918 and 21 in the civil wars in Eastern Europe. And plenty of the great cultural bastions of Judaism suffered horrible losses. So for all these reasons, and further, in interwar period, in Poland, which was the largest Jewish community that was not cut off, had 3 million Jews, there was the Polification or Polonization of Jewry. What language did the girls speak in Poland in the 1920s and 30s? Polish. What did the boys speak? Yiddish. The girls learned Polish, the boys didn't, because the girls went to public school, the boy went to cheder. But still, who's learning Hebrew? Very few. The Tarbut schools existed, but had very little funding. So they cry foul, and they tell the WZO, we need, just like there's a Karen Kiamat Yisrael, and there's a Karen HaYesod for land purchases, we need a Karen HaTarbut. We need a fund that is allocating money to in Israel and beyond Israel for cultural purposes. Because if we don't do this, we're not going to know Hebrew. By the way, what was the end result? Nobody knows Hebrew in America. How many Jews know Hebrew? How many people in this room are fluent in spoken Hebrew? You know, it's a problem. Yeah.
When I went to day school in the 50s, all my teachers spoke.
Because those teachers who taught in America were from the cream of the crop that went to the Tarbut schools in Europe, or they went to Herzliya in New York.
Well, right. And because we were so immersed,
yeah.
I still speak. I remember my Hebrew from those
So
days.
Some people are lucky enough to have had such teachers. Well, some people. Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing. You know,
we're very devoted.
Yeah.
Very devoted. You know, Rabbi Lichtenstein's mother was my teacher.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
And you could not speak English.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Get it, even
right.
Researched.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, once you bring that up already, because you made it seem for
yeah.
a moment, starting that era, it's an RJJ. Yeah. Tosadas had this. I understand Berlin had this. RJJ had two tracks.
Ah.
Uh-huh. It had Yiddish.
Right.
Yiddish.
Right. Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
Even in my day. And the kids that went to Yiddish were mostly the Holocaust
survivors' children.
Survivors' children.
Right.
In our class, in our English class. The Hebrew,
the Americans, right.
Yeah.
Most of them learned Yiddish.
Okay, so I just want to, just a few more points, we're running out of time. So, the David Ben-Gurion, in 1935, the year of the great immigration of 62,000 Jews, he was concerned that the diaspora will flood us, will overflow us, that there are too many people coming from the outside, and we need them, but they're not exactly the right kind of Jews, and they're going to flood us, that we, the Yishuv, the truly Palestinian indigenous Yishuv, are going to be overwhelmed by people who are not subscribing to our way of life, and that will change the character, in a detrimental way, of the broader Yishuv. So it was said that there was an anxiety among the labor chalutzim elite, that whereas the chalutzim, the pioneers, bring geula, redemption, the mehagrim only bring hatzalat nefashot. What are mehagrim? Emigrants. People who, like from the Arabic word, hajj, you know, it became a Hebrew word. So Mehagrim are people who move from point A to point B to escape the bad in point A for a better life in point B, but not for ideological reasons. So whereas the Chalutzim, who have an ideological fervor, they will bring redemption, Geula, the Mehagrim are only bringing Hatzalat Nefashot. They're saving their own necks, but they're bringing nothing to the table in terms of the national project. Okay. Bialik, who died in 1934, but a year before he died, already when Hitler took power in 1933, and Bialik saw that there is a tremendous increase in immigration to Eretz Yisrael, he said, Zionism lacks Ruach HaKodesh. Now, what does he mean by Ruach HaKodesh? Traditionally, Ruach HaKodesh is like Nevuah, prophecy. It's a lower version of prophecy. But what he meant was, it lacks a neshama. That instead of Ruach HaKodesh, it's just an escape from Hitlerism. It's an escape from Hitlerism, but has no Ruach HaKodesh. So he, Bialik, who was not a traditional Jew in the Orthodox sense, but he went to Volozhin and he didn't like it in Volozhin. But he was a shulgoer sometimes, just for old time's sake. He wanted Zionism with a neshama. All right. It was said that those who arrived in Palestine were of the 70 cultures and the 70 languages, like the Shivim Umot Ha'olam in the Jewish tradition, the 70 nations of the world, that the Jews who are coming are like the Jewish Goyim. They're from the 70 nations of the world, but not our nation. They don't seem like us. They're from a hodgepodge of countries, and the Eretz Yisrael is becoming a Tower of Babel, a Migdal Babel. Another term that was used was that if you go on the street, linguistically, it's tohu vavohu, out of Bereshis, you know, second line of Bereshis, and it was welter and waste, tohu vavohu. So all these expressions are being thrown around about how horrible it is, culturally speaking. All right, in the end, they're all worked out well. But how do you solve the problem? So there were a few solutions. I mentioned, you sponsor writers, you give Bible lessons, you give lessons in Agadot, you give lessons in Musar, various Judaic studies, even not in Hebrew. Even if the Judaic studies is being given in a foreign language, better that they should learn some Torah than nothing at all.
And these are the Zionists?
And these are the Zionists. So for a few years, they had to suspend their either hostility or general indifference to matters of Yahadut as a religion, as a dot, and say to themselves, we need the religion to salvage the nationalism. Ben-Gurion, in his approach towards Aliyah from various countries around the world, including Sephardic and Middle Eastern countries, he always would say, as long as the people know how to read out of the Siddur, we're okay. Like the Moroccan Jews were largely illiterate, and there was a lot of disdain held for Moroccan Jews, but they could read out of the Siddur, and that was good enough, because then you could bring them in, and there's what to work with, there's material to work with, yeah. Okay, good. So where did they go is an easier question to answer. The fifth Aliyah hardly went at all to the rural kibbutzim and moshavot. Mostly they went to the three large cities, Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, Haifa. And they built, huh? And Naharia among the lesser cities, okay? So, and Naharia became a German colony, effectively. But the vast bulk went to the three major cities, which ballooned the population of Tel Aviv. Jerusalem was already a fairly large city from before because of the Arab population and the old Yishuv, and plus it had been a focus for the first and second Aliyah as well. But these newer cities grow exponentially. In the case of Haifa, it helps balance out the demographic of Arab and Jewish. It was a largely Arab city, but by the 1940s, it's a mixed city and then becomes not exclusively a Jewish city, but a very heavily Jewish city because a substantial portion of the population leaves during the war. Okay, so they're going to... Arab population, yeah. So these centers grow, and it is troubling to the labor Zionist leadership, because what had been the policy ever since the 29 riots? The policy since the 29 riots had been, we want territorial contiguity, but to be as widely dispersed as possible, because come the big war, the big conflagration between us and the Arabs, we want to have people in as many parts of the country as possible, connected to each other, of course, but you need to spread out, otherwise the Jewish portion of Palestine that is going to go to a Jewish state is going to be small. So this was a troubling aspect of the Fifth Aliyah. The solution to it is to send people who are willing to kind of far-flung places to hold the ground. And in the late 30s, in the era of the Chomal Migdal, the Tower and Stockade settlements, those will be put in positions that are sensitive, that need to be occupied by Jews. Okay. So Tveria and Tzfat were mixed cities that were becoming increasingly Jewish as the Yishuv grew in size. But Tzfat in particular would not become majority Jewish until the War of Independence. Yeah.
A similar approach was adopted by Gush Emunim after the Six-Day War.
Yeah.
Whatever you're describing.
Right. No, the thinking is that the government, the sinister government, is going to give away territory. So we have to place ourselves strategically so the government can't give away territory. All right. Yeah.
Just to roll back, what you touched on is pretty different. That the government also, when the Sephardim came in after the war, in 1948, they wanted to rid them of their religious perspective.
So it's not entirely true. That's not entirely true. Well, the kidnapping, that is true. But you're right that there was a desire to change cultural habits between 1949 and 53 among the recent arrivals from North Africa and the Middle East. But there, the issue was sort of the perceived backward nature of people who were arriving and trying to elevate them to an Ashkenazic standard. Whereas in the 30s, the issue was simply a non-Jewish perspective, a goyish approach to life that had to be made more Jewish. Okay, so last few points to make. What can be done coercively to make recent arrivals blend in? What can be done coercively? So one thing is, So one thing is, don't hire somebody for a job unless he goes to the Ulpan. There's no government that's going to force it. The British mandate doesn't care one way or the other what people speak, and the British mandate is the government. Everything is the yeshuv is a voluntary association. Very, always important to bear this in mind. Throughout our whole discussion for this period of time, from the first Aliyah up till 1948, everything is of a voluntary character. The government is not the Jews. They can't coerce people. However, to threaten somebody, you're not going to get a job, whether in my factory or in any Histadrut-affiliated organization, unless you go to the Ulpan and start speaking Hebrew, well, that's a threat that people have to take seriously. Alternatively, social ostracism of people who are caught speaking non-Hebraic languages on the street. Non-Hebraic, okay. In other words, if you're not trying to speak Hebrew, meaning if you don't do a good job of it, but you're trying, then we cut you some slack. But if it's clear that you're just speaking 100% fluent German or whatever it is, Yiddish, they might cut you some slack. But it's half Hebraic. No, it's true. Yiddish was not as problematic because there was a certain tolerance for it. Not among the crazies, the real fundamentalists, but German, or for that matter, Dutch or French, they wanted you to stop speaking it. Polish or Hungarian, yeah, no more. Okay, so social ostracism. Another is that you take violent measures. So the Gedud Maginei HaSafa HaYivrit, the Battalion of the Defenders of the Hebrew Language, they were like right-wing hooligans. I spoke about them a few weeks ago, that they interrupted lectures and they caused a lot of trouble. They broke down signs that weren't in Hebrew. Those were revisionist lunatics. But a more moderate version of that was the Ha'igud LeHashlatat HaYivrit, the committee or the organization for the victory of the compulsion of the Hebrew language, that there should be shlita, that Hebrew should win the day. In a battle royale of languages, Hebrew should win. Okay.
Wasn't the program of Hashemah a way of acculturating
Yes, Hakshara was very important in getting people to be on the land, to speak Hebrew, to get them ready in the diaspora for life in Eretz Yisrael. But for those who were fleeing from Central Europe under the era of fascism, Hakshara was a non-factor. They were not going to Hakshara. They were just jumping. They were getting out as quickly as they could. As soon as it was possible, they would leave. So there is no Hakshara, which means you're getting to Eretz Yisrael a fish out of water. Okay. We have 5 minutes left. I just want to make one point I forgot from earlier. Were there ever any examples of Jewish boycotts of anti-Semitism that actually were successful? That those who would criticize the Hesken HaAvara, the transfer agreement, on the grounds that it negated the possibility of a successful boycott. But were there ever successful boycotts?
In the States,
this period?
We had boycotts.
Earlier than 1933. Was there precedent for the Jews to boycott something and gain from it? So there are two examples.
Well, there's the meat boycott, but that's against other Jews.
Oh, you mean with Rabbi Jacob Yosef?
Yeah.
Okay, on the Lower East Side. You're right.
That was a civil war.
That was a civil war. And it ended with with his unfortunate demise. So there are two examples that people quoted as indicating precedent. One was in 1911, there was a brief American Jewish boycott of Tsarist Russia. Why Tsarist Russia? Because Tsarist Russia was treating Jews as Jews and not as American citizens. If you went back to Russia, despite having been naturalized as a U.S. citizen, you were still treated as a Jewish subject of the Tsar with all the disabilities that entailed. Now, from an American perspective, that's a disgrace. Once you're an American citizen, you have a passport, you're an American. And you go anywhere in the world, you want to be treated as an American citizen, not as a third-class person.
About Jews who left the United States and went back to Russia to live?
No, even on business or visiting. Yeah.
And the Russians treated them like...
Yes. So the United States canceled a commercial treaty with the Romanov regime, with the Tsarist regime in 1911 because of American Jewish protests. However, Taft. But did it actually help the Jews of Russia? The answer is no. And the obvious proof is that Mendel Bayless was arrested a few minutes later, and there was a blood libel. So it didn't help. What's another example? American Jews boycotted Henry Ford. What was Henry Ford doing in the Dearborn Independent? Serializing the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. Okay. So, and what happened? In 1921, he backed off. He issued a non-apology apology, and he backed off. So you could see that sometimes boycotts have an effect, not necessarily the greatest effect, but something. So that was what was used by those who criticized Havara, that you're undermining a cause that could be effective. Okay, last point for tonight. What was the ultimate impact of the Fifth Aliyah? The Yeshuv was at 175,000 people, 1931. It's at 450,000 people, 1939. A tremendous increase. Almost a threefold increase. And the difference between 1920s Yeshuv and 1930s Yeshuv is that in the 1920s, the Jewish national home was an experiment. An experiment that could have been crushed at any time. It did not have great weight or heft to it. By the 1930s, especially by the mid to late 30s, the yeshuv now was large enough that although it's not big enough for independence, it's demographically smaller than the Arabs, it cannot be crushed so easily, and it can prevent the establishment of an Arab Palestine. In other words, it's not enough to be sovereign on its own, but it could prevent the other guy from negating the effects of the Jewish home. Because of the numbers and because of the economic power relative to the Arab economy. Yeah.
So while the Jews were increasing from 175 to 450, what was the Arab population going to?
Okay, so the Arab population was also increasing, but not nearly as rapidly, and the percentage of Jews in the overall population went from 16% to 30%, which is a big jump.
But you said 175 to 450. Yeah.
62 was in 1 year. Some years were bigger than others. 33, 34, 35, 36 were tremendous years. 37, 38, 39 were considerably smaller. The bulk was 32 to 36, really. Yeah.
No, but when you take in perspective the amount of people that moved in, you can understand why they're trying to preserve the language, because
the percentage of Hebrew speakers among the Jews was declining.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, so what do the Arabs think about all this? The Arabs see that the country is changing. The Arabs national movement has been around since, well, it depends on when you want to claim the Arab national movement started. It's a debatable point. And the Zionists always preferred to say that it didn't exist at all. But realistically, it was around since the 1920s, the 20 riots, the 21 riots, 29 riots. All this is nationalist fervor. It's not just killing the Jews for the sake of killing Jews. It's a reaction to the growth of the Yishuv. Well, the Arabs are now in a position where they really have to worry about losing the country, losing control over the country. And so they're going to rise up in some violent outburst at some point in time. The only question is when. And from the Zionist point of view, the hope is just, well, not today and not tomorrow, not a week from now. Let's push it off as far as we can, because so long as there's peace, the flow of population can continue into the country. Once hostilities break out, what's inevitably going to happen? What are the British going to do? Curtail immigration. So fortunately, from a Jewish perspective, from 29 to 36, very little happened on the Arab front. Next week, when we discuss the Arab riots, I'll mention how there was Izzeddin al-Qassam in 1935. There were certain bands of terrorists who did bad things, but nothing of a widespread nature happened for a good 7 years. And that made all the difference. We'll stop here.